happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking during this hour with a continuation of our conversations with Remarkable Minds. The topic is behind the rhetoric of economic recovery, the real economic conditions in the United States. My guest is Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. He is one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation. He understands government dysfunction, political corruption, global and domestic economic threats, the war on terror, Wall Street, and the decline in human values in American society. He was the chairman of the Institute for Political Economics and a former assistant secretary of the Treasury during Ronald Reagan's first term. And during his academic career, he has taught at many universities and held the William Simon Chair of Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University. Dr. Roberts' blog can be found at paulcraigroberts.org. He's published many books and articles over the past 40 years, his latest being The Neoconservative Threat to World Order, Washington's Perilous War of Hegemony. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleased to be with you, Gary.
We have heard during the campaign from the Democratic side how much of a recovery the U.S. has been in. We continue to hear what I consider spurious employment statistics that would indicate that the recession is over and Obama has pulled the nation through economically. The Democrats want us to believe that there is nothing fundamentally wrong with the system and that we just need to tweak it and improve things here and there and maintain the same course. So what is this to you as far as accurate or inaccurate?
It's entirely propaganda. They produce the image of recovery in two ways. One of the ways they do it is they understate the measurement of inflation. For example, if the price of an item in the inflation index rises, they throw the item out and stick in a cheaper one. Alternatively, they will say it's not a price rise, it's a quality improvement. So they don't measure their inflation. Now, anyone who shops for groceries, home repairs, pays utility bills, they know there's a good bit of inflation. But if you don't measure it, then when you take the gross domestic product figure, which is always in nominal terms, and you deflate it, the reason you have to deflate it is to be able to tell whether the increase in GDP is due to price rises or to an increase in real output. So since they have an understated measure of inflation, when they deflate the GDP number, they don't take much out of it. And so they end up counting inflation as real growth. So that's one way they create this image of recovery. And the other way, of course, is the massive amounts of money that are pumped into the world financial system by the large central banks, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the Japanese Central Bank, the Bank of England. This money has to go somewhere. It doesn't go into debt instruments because of zero interest rates. The only place for it to go is into stock markets. And so the PE ratios of American stocks are extremely high. So with all this money coming out and with nowhere to go but stock prices, it looks like you have a strong stock market. So those are the two main features of their recovery. And they're both illusions for the reasons I gave you.
Recently, Richard Gehl, one of our scholars in residence who you know, and I spent about 2 weeks looking at official statistics and just added up, very simply, the following. How much total debt do we have? As close a guesstimate as we could have. For example, credit card debt, around $1 trillion. Student debt, $1.3 trillion. Car loan debt, about $900 billion. The mortgage debt, around $16 trillion. Corporate debt, $25 trillion. Federal debt, as far as our what we're telling the world, $9.4 trillion. Then we have pension deficit debt, meaning we don't have the money there to pay people's pensions when they retire, and it's much like a Ponzi scheme, and that's $8 trillion. The state debt, where they cannot balance their budgets, over $5 trillion. Then you get into underfunded entitlements, or unfunded entitlements, and you're nearly at $60 to $70 trillion, depending upon whose figures. And we did the math, and we came up to where we are well above $165 trillion in debt, with a gross domestic product of around $18.4 trillion, which means we have 900% debt to gross domestic product. We have 106 million Americans who have work, could work, but cannot find full-time work, and they're not included in the unemployment statistics. And so I'm trying to ask, how in the world could Obama or the media, who are complicit in this because they're not, they have the resources to do the same work we did, not say we are bankrupt? Why can't we be honest about how bad it is? Why do we continue to lie? Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, the lies serve the appearance of American success. I mean, we're the indispensable people, the exceptional people. We're chosen by history to impose hegemony on the world. So you can't have such an exalted status if you declare what your real situation is. I'm sympathetic to the counting up of all the debt, but I think that's a very old conservative approach to looking at things. It seems to me that what we need to look at is what's happening to the real incomes of American people. Once the corporations started moving offshore, the manufacturing jobs and then the tradable professional skill jobs like software engineering, research, design, the future for the middle class disappeared. And with the movement of these middle-class jobs offshore also went the income associated with the jobs, the tax base for the cities and states, and the federal government as well. And U.S. real median family income went into decline, so that every year Americans are poorer than they were the previous year. The jobs that they report the first Friday of every month, the payroll jobs report, these jobs are always part-time, lowly paid domestic service jobs, waitresses, bartenders, hospital orderlies, retail clerks. These are third world jobs. These are jobs characteristic of third world economy. So even if you believe the job numbers, and I have explained over and over that they are made up, they're not really there. The type of jobs that they claim show a failed economy. So if you look at the fact that real incomes can't grow, then you see there's nothing to drive the economy. There's no discretionary consumer spending power. And then you add to this policy of zero interest rates, which is done entirely for the big banks. You add that in what's happening to retirees. They have no income from their savings to supplement their Social Security or any kind of company pension they might still have. And so they have to draw down their capital. So instead of living on the income from their savings, they're having to use up their savings. So there's nothing for their heirs. So in effect, the United States is being dispossessed of its living standard. And this is what's happening. And this is why it's such a critical situation. We are moving from a first world country, the top of the first world, where we once were, to third world status. That's what's happening to America economically.
Let's break that down a little further, if you would, please. I did an analysis to find that we don't have an economy. We have nine economies. And depending upon which economy that you may be in, you are either given some attention, a lot of attention, all the attention, or zero attention. For example, we have over 8 million millionaires in the United States. That's excluding what their property they own. We have billionaires. We have those who have from $10 to $20 million. And different segments, all those people add up to almost 9 million people. But then we have your entrepreneurial class. We have about 40 million people, many retired, living in gated communities around the United States. They would be placed at the upper end of the upper middle class, meaning they have no debt, they have assets. Generally, their homes are paid unless they've mortgaged them for their children's education. But they were ultra-conservative when it came to not growing their capital through investment, but rather growing their capital through their labor. So if their restaurant or their bowling alley or their shoe store was successful, they took that money, maintained their expenses, and then put the rest of that away into savings of different types. They're more interested in keeping what they've saved rather than risking it in some venture or hedge fund and growing it artificially. You have another group of people who are the professional class: lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, accountants. Those individuals represent over 7 million people. Then you have the bureaucratic class: police officers, firefighters, school teachers, people who have a security. They generally are in debt, but their wages are able to help sustain their cash flows, and they can service their debt. Then you have a huge number of people in the working middle class, and that's the group that's shrinking because they frequently can no longer, as you mentioned, take home enough money to pay their bills, pay their standard of living, and then pay their debt. So they frequently have multiple credit cards, and they're what are called kiting the credit cards. You pay one credit card with another credit card, and then that credit card with another credit card. But the debt is still there, and you're paying anywhere from 18 to 100% interest, depending upon if you're late and delayed or making partial payments. And those people struggle. Then you have the working poor. There are over 145 million working poor. At the very low end, you have 4 million people earning less than $2 a day or living on less than $2 a day. You have 49 million people on food stamps. You have 18 million hungry children. You have 1.5 million homeless children going to school. And these people are virtually invisible. You don't see them. You've had over 30 million Americans dispossessed from their homes, 8 million homes, 4 people per home. So what we're having now is we're not looking at what we can do for all those people who need help, and we're putting all the energy into the top 2%. Your thoughts on this?
Well, Gary, I think that it's really like the top 0.1%, where the real wealth is. To be a millionaire today, I mean, it's nice compared to not being one, but it doesn't produce the income that you would have gotten from being a manufacturing worker building cars in Detroit. In fact, it doesn't produce any income unless you gamble it in a stock casino. Now, as for what some people do with the amount of money they've saved, whether they use it for entrepreneurship or invest it, for real investment to take place, it has to be consumer demand. It has to be growing consumer demand. But since nobody's incomes are growing, but the 1%, there's no consumer demand. So there's absolutely no opportunity for investing in new businesses and so on, or very little opportunity. Nothing like opportunity that once existed when, in general, income levels were rising. Today, what income levels rise? Hardly any. As for the doctors and the lawyers, well, if they've been out a long time, they haven't established practice, they're probably doing okay. They have a hard time collecting from insurance companies. They have a hard time collecting from Medicare. They get paid a small fraction of their billings from Medicare if they service Medicare patients. But if they are not established, they haven't been out, they're new, they got big student loans. It's hard to get a practice going. It's almost impossible just to come out of law school and hang up your shingle and start being a lawyer. You try to find a job. You try to get some training. You try to learn the ropes. And the jobs for lawyers have disappeared too. All kinds of lawyers are graduated out there, and they haven't got employment. It happens even to engineers. So I don't like the notion that only the poor are really doing bad. What's happened is that the ladders of upward mobility that let poor people rise, they've been taken down. And the main cause of that was the jobs offshoring. So what we have is a system that, for the sake of the short-run profits of global corporations, stopped its ability to create a general increase in income for the population by giving away the high productivity, high value added jobs to foreign countries. That's the way I see it. And of course, there's always plenty of money for wars and plenty of money for bailing out banks too big to fail. And what we have in the United States today is an oligarchy. We're ruled by the military security complex, Wall Street, agribusiness, you know, firms like Monsanto that are so powerful they can even prevent the labeling of GMO foods. The extractive industries, energy, mining, timber, these are the powerful forces. They write the laws, they determine the regulations, and their interests, if you look at the career of any executive, they're CEO for a few years. That's their chance to make their fortune. And they make their fortune by focusing on short-term profits. And everybody else pays the price. So that's how we got in this fix. And it's hard to get out of a fix like this, Gary, once you get into it.
Let's take a little deeper look at one issue. That is, a lot of people are saying, We're thriving because look at Wall Street. We've broken records. We've broken the 18,000 number on Wall Street. And then look at bonds. Bonds are really heavy out there. And yet, right now, there are $14 to $16 trillion in bonds with negative returns. I would want to know why someone would invest in a bond in a market where bonds and stocks, equities are both bubbles simultaneously, which they really shouldn't be. And yet you have both as bubbles, and we're being told invest in bonds, invest in equities. You're getting zero interest on the bonds. You're getting zero interest out of banks. And people don't understand how Wall Street became a bubble, and they think, well, if I go into stocks, I'll be all right. Explain stocks, bonds, and bubbles.
Well, the bubbles are due to the central bank money creation that began with Alan Greenspan back at the beginning of the 21st century. The first real estate bubble was a consequence of the Greenspan monetary expansion. Now, why did Alan create so much credit? He created the credit because he was aware that the offshoring of jobs had stopped the ability of the economy to grow as a result of rises in real consumer incomes. That is, as a result of a growth in discretionary spending power on the part of consumers. When that stopped growing, there was no way, when the income stopped growing, the real income, there was no way to drive the real GDP. And so Greenspan said, I know what I'll do. I'll substitute the expansion of consumer credit for the missing growth in consumer income. And so their spending will increase because they go into debt and they borrow the money to spend. This was one of the principal reasons for driving up the real estate prices with low interest rates, because people could refinance the house at its now higher value, actually end up with the same size mortgage payment because of the fall in interest rates, and have tens of thousands of dollars to spend. And so the whole beginning of this, beginning of the 21st century, was Greenspan substituting the growth in consumer debt for the missing growth in consumer income. Now, we add to that the deregulation of the financial system that happened under the Clinton administration, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the merging of commercial and investment banking, and we got massive fraud thrown in with massive money creation. All of these extraordinary derivatives that no one knows the consequences of. And we got a very unstable financial system that blew up on us. Now, instead of letting the banks fail, the new Federal Reserve, the Bernanke Federal Reserve, said, oh, we can't have the banks fail. It'll pull down too many other things. And what he really meant is the banks rule us, and they won't let us let them fail. And so we are going to bail them out with massive money creation. And we're going to use this money to purchase federal bonds, U.S. Treasury securities, because interest rates move together. And by purchasing these bonds, we drive up the price. That means we drive up the price of all debt assets, including the bad debt assets, the mortgage-backed securities on the bank's balance sheets. So in this way, we can preserve the balance sheet, the solvency of the big banks that we don't want to fail. And so all of this money comes out, and it drives up the bond prices, which means it lowers the interest rates. And where does the money go? A lot of people were worried it's going to go into the economy and cause hyperinflation. But it didn't get into the economy, or not very much of it. It got into financial asset prices, stocks, and bonds. That's why we had the boom, and why we still have the boom in the Dow Jones and the stock averages. All that money has to go somewhere. Now, with bond prices bid up, such that there's no net return either from capital gains or from interest. It's stocks. So the money goes into stocks because there's nowhere else for it to go. And therefore, the high P.E. ratios that people look at and say, well, this is unprecedented. These stocks are overvalued, blah, blah. Well, they are, except for the fact that all this money's there. And where's the money going? It's going into stock prices. So as long as the Federal Reserve can keep this going, I mean, it is a house of cards. But as long as they're willing to create money, and it goes into financial asset prices, the interest rates will stay low and the stock prices will stay high.
What is the danger of either the bond or stock market bubble bursting? And what do you see the likely timeline or probable timeline being? And how far down do you think Wall Street could go? It's currently at 18,000 because a lot of people have a lot invested in stocks and bonds.
Gary, I don't know how many individuals are still in the market, but it's gone on much longer than I thought it could. It's a house of cards, and I have come to the conclusion it can continue to exist until there's an international run on the dollar. Something has to happen that causes the dollar to come under enormous pressure and start dropping in exchange value. Now, when that was happening because of the rise in the gold price, the Federal Reserve had the bullion bank step in and sell naked shorts in the gold futures market. That's a way of printing up paper gold, just like you can print up dollars. You can, a naked short is an uncovered contract. So the bullion banks could sit there and say, oh, let's create 40 tons more of gold right now. We'll create these contracts and we'll go dump them in the futures market. That will drive the gold price down. They've been doing this consistently since about September of 2011. So that's how they keep the dollar from losing value relative to gold, and thereby people saying, well, look, the dollar's going. How they do it with other foreign currencies, well, first of all, what are the big ones? It's the Japanese yen. It's the euro. But what is the Japanese central bank doing? It's printing yen as fast as it can. What's the European central bank doing? It's printing euros as fast as it can. What's the Bank of England doing? It's printing pounds as fast as it can. Well, if all the other currencies are being printed, there's no reason for the dollar to lose exchange value relative to them. And so the situation is stable. So what would have to happen is for some reason, the dollar starts falling relative to other currencies. That could happen if the European Central Bank stopped printing, if the Japanese central bank stop printing, but they won't because they are not independent of the United States. Their policy is governed from Washington. They won't go against the Federal Reserve. They won't go against Washington. They are part of the American empire. And so the situation is stable. You see what I mean? Something has to happen to cause people say, we don't trust the dollar any longer. I don't want to hold dollar-denominated assets. The minute that happens, the price of the dollar starts falling, then the Fed has a choice. It has to say, well, look, if the dollar falls and we lose the reserve currency role, we lose our power because our power is based on the fact that we can pay our bills by printing money. Nobody else can do that. That's because we're the world reserve currency. So we've got to save the dollar. How do you do that? You raise interest rates to attract capital flows. And there you have to let the banks go and you have to let the stock market go. So That's my answer to your question. I don't know what could cause a loss of confidence in the dollar. I don't know when it would happen. I didn't think it could go on so many years as it's happened, but it has. So that's all I can say about it.
Do you see China, now that it has been accepted as one of the world currencies of exchange, do you see the China playing any role in challenging the dollar in the future?
You know, if the Chinese continue to be economically successful, and if they can develop their internal markets as well as they developed their export markets, they won't need to challenge us. They will just naturally rise. And people will start to see more investment returns from China. They'll see less risk. They'll say, well, look, look what's happening. The same thing could happen in Russia. And so that you would have a gradual fall in the dollar, not a crisis fall, but a gradual fall. And this would make Americans even poorer over time, because the purchasing power of their currency falls, but so many of the products they buy from American companies are manufactured in China. They're offshore production of American firms. And so if the dollar goes, then that takes down more American living standards. So if that's the scenario where China continues to be successful, it shifts its development from export markets to domestic markets. It has a huge potential consumer market, 1.3 billion people. Then, yes, you would see the dollar losing its role, the Chinese currency gaining a stronger role. But this doesn't imply a sudden crisis. This is an adjustment over time. And it may be that what we are faced with is just a growing, slow impoverishment. And then when we can't service our massive debts, I mean, these debts that you added up, when you can't service them because people don't accept your currency as payment the way they used to, because it's not the reserve currency any longer, or not much of one, then the debt problems start eating into living standards. So it's not a happy picture, however you shuffle it. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Both Clinton and Trump have put forth their economic plans. What do you see as the strength or weaknesses of either one?
You know, the only hope I don't see, look, Hillary is a bought and paid for agent of the oligarchs. If we get her, it'll be worse everywhere than ever before. Trump, the only hopeful thing is he questions the offshoring of the jobs. Now, he's the only one that questions it, because Americans are brainwashed into believing that jobs offshoring is free trade, and we all benefit from free trade, even as we lose millions of jobs and our living standards plummet, we are benefiting. As long as Americans are stupid enough to believe that story, it's kind of hopeless. But Trump at least says, I don't buy this offshoring of the jobs. Now, if he sticks to that, maybe he could find some way to reverse it. It would be very difficult because the corporations benefit from it. The reason they offshore the jobs, Gary, is because the labor costs drop dramatically, and therefore what they were paying in wages goes directly into profits and managerial bonuses and rise in the share price and capital gains for the shareholders. So for the owners of the companies, the offshoring is a wonderful thing. But for everybody else and the economy, it's disastrous. So Trump would be up against the global corporations. Would he prevail? I don't know. And what could he do, even if he prevails? The only thing that I could think of, and this really, I think, was the idea, yes, I forgot his name. But the only thing I can think of is that if Trump was able to change the way American corporations are taxed, such that they are taxed on the geographical location at which they add value to their product. For in other words, if they produce the goods that they market to Americans offshore, they would have a high tax rate. But if they produce the goods that they market to Americans domestically within the United States, they would have a low tax rate. And so the difference in the tax rate could be used to wipe out the difference in the labor cost of paying wages in Indonesia or China as compared to paying them in the United States. So that would be a way that Trump could force the corporations to bring back into the United States the production of the goods and services that they sell to Americans. The reason we have the income problem is that all of the incomes associated with the production of goods and services that Americans consume belong to foreigners, not to Americans. And therefore, they don't get the income from the production of the goods they buy as part of their wages. And that's why we're going poor. So that's all I can think of. That's the only answer I could give. I don't think it's possible to look to Hillary for hope on anything. And Trump, which is a strong individual, and he has said some things that are hopeful. He's the only one who said he doesn't want war with Russia and China. He doesn't see the point of NATO. He doesn't see the point of the mass immigration, especially the undocumented part. And he doesn't see the point of the offshoring of American jobs. Now, what other politician said that? None of them. They all fostered it. They all fostered it. And he's questioning it. So there's some hope. It doesn't mean he can do anything. Presidents aren't necessarily the powerful people that people think. It depends on who staffs their government, what kind of corporation he can get out of his own government, what kind of corporation he can get out of the Congress. The Congress, of course, is controlled by the interest groups. And the interest groups will say, no, don't go along with Trump. So it's not clear anything much can happen.
The likelihood of the TPP or the TIPP getting passed and the consequences, especially as President Obama just this week once again said that this is he wants this passed because of his legacy. And tell us your thoughts on the TPP and the TIPP.
Okay. First of all, Obama hasn't the foggiest idea of what either one of them do. And somebody told him something about this will be your legacy. He said, oh, okay, all right, this will be my legacy. He doesn't know. What these things do, Gary, they have nothing whatsoever to do with trade. What both of these so-called partnerships do is to make global corporations immune to the laws of the countries in which they do business. For example, we know today that France has laws against GMOs, genetically modified organisms. We know that they're being lobbied very hard by Washington, by the American ambassador in Paris, by Monsanto, to give it up and accept them. Well, under the TTIP, if France signs that agreement, then Monsanto can bring suit against France in a tribunal in which only corporations serve as judges and demand damages from France for reducing their profits by preventing the sale of GMO products. In other words, France has to pay out of its nose or give up the anti-GMO laws. This is what it means. And not just, I'm not just talking about GMOs. It means if a country has certain labor regulations and the company can say, well, to comply with these regulations eats up our profits, and so you've got to pay us. Or health standards. Even it can endanger the national health programs in Europe, because the companies can say, well, I want to start a private health business, but look, you're giving free medical care, and so that's interferes with my ability to make money, and so you got to give up your national health system. All of these things are what would come out of these two partnerships. Now, you may remember that somebody, Greenpeace or somebody, got a hold of a lot of the TTIP documents. You know, all this is negotiated in secret because if anybody knew what it was, they would be absolutely angry. Greenpeace released some of these, and it was a sensation for a while. And it did wake up, to some extent, the Europeans. Whether they'll remember after all the terror events in France and elsewhere, Germany, it remains to be seen. But if these things pass, and of course bribes, heavy bribes will be paid, heavy threats made, then it simply means a global corporation is not subject to laws in the countries in which they do business. That's what it means.
I'm looking today at the New York Times front page, and I've been monitoring it three times a day for the last 2 months. And what I've found is a consistent pattern. Praising Hillary, never once challenging her on, example, the consequences of her campaign in Libya, because she was the deciding factor. The campaign which he helped sponsored with the Honduras coup, the consequences of her campaign against Venezuela, also her campaign with Nuland in Russia or in the Ukraine in that coup, and also her support for funding the so-called moderate terrorists using Gaddafi's weapons and using the Annex and Stevens to funnel those weapons of Gaddafi to both Syria and through Turkey back into Syria, which is she has denied. In fact, she denied that to Rand Paul. And I think that if WikiLeaks comes up with proof that she knowingly lied to Congress, then they could bypass the FBI and bypass the Justice Department, and Congress could indict her. In any case, nothing about her and her husband's co-presidency, the balkanization of Yugoslavia, the unnecessary deaths of 500,000 children from sanctions and polluted water in Iraq in the 1980s or 90s, and nothing at all about the fact that her foundation received money from NBC, MSNBC, Comcast, HBO, Time Warner, Time, all these major news outlets. Then you have to ask the question, if a news outlet is willing to give money to a Clinton Foundation, then what is the likelihood that they would be critical in assessing her career and her associations? Also, not a single investigation into the background of her vice president choice, who is pro-Trans-Pacific Partnership, pro all these treaties and agreements, and her not backing down on criminalizing drug use, not wanting to give up on the war on drugs, her support from private prison corporations and her flip-flopping on every major issue. She has said yes at one time and then no at another time. Nothing critical. And yet at the top of the page on the left-hand side today, embattled chief leaves Trump's campaign days after shakeup. But not a word about the consequences of the WikiLeaks showing that the DMC intentionally with malice aforethought undermined Bernie Sanders and supported Hillary Clinton, something that was completely unethical, if not illegal. And then she immediately, upon her resignation, she hires her. And no editorial on that. Yet every single thing on the left-hand side today is about the GOP worries falling Trump tide will lower all boats. The run-up podcast knowing the Trump voter. Now, this is interesting because you work for the Wall Street Journal. You were a highly respected journalist. Here's a look at what they consider the Trump voter. And this is what has been parroted all over the media. They're generally a white, uneducated person, frequently a person tending towards racism. The Ku Klux Klan has been associated with the Trump. And these are illiterate people who are frequently misogynist, anti-government. And yet I lived in Canning, Pennsylvania. I lived in Weirton, West Virginia, in Steubenville, in Wheeling, West Virginia. And the places where you had gainful employment, and now I know there's no gainful employment. These are not racist. They are not misogynist. They have nothing to do with Ku Klux Klan. These are just normal, average people who want a job to be able to cover the expenses for their family. And instead of acknowledging that these people are there and that Obama and Clinton were responsible for a lot of offshoring of jobs and taking away what welfare system was helping these people in their hour of need, they demonize them. I believe that will come back to haunt them at some point. But right now, the New York Times is 100% the biggest cheerleader for Hillary Clinton, and that just smacks of terrible biased journalism. Those are my personal thoughts. I'd like to hear yours, please.
Well, I think it's worse than that, Gary. There are no American news outlets. There's a propaganda ministry. It was created by the Clintons when they permitted six corporations to purchase 90% of the American media. So you've got 90% of the media concentrated in six hands. It has no independence. The reporters have no independence. The editors have no independence. The companies are run by former government officials, by corporate advertising executives. The value of these mega companies is their federal broadcast licenses. They can't go against the interest groups that control Washington. And the players in Washington are all agents of the interest groups. The politicians, hardly any of the politicians, have any independence. They're interest group controlled. Do you think the Clintons aren't agents of the powerful interest groups? How else do you explain the $1.6 billion in their foundation? How do you explain the $120 million personal fortune? How do you explain the years after years of $250,000 speeches from the big corporations, the big banks? They're bought and paid for. So is the media. There's no independent media, not in the print or TV. And so the media is a propaganda mechanism that serves the agenda of the oligarchs that control the politics. And so you shouldn't be surprised to hear the media trying to elect Hillary, who is the agent of the oligarchs. Trump, an outsider, a strong personality. How can they control him? They don't know. They don't want to take a chance. So he's out. And that's what this is all about. The New York Times is not an independent voice. It speaks for the ruling elite. It speaks for the oligarchs. So that's the reason that what you see, this sort of, you might say, oh, this is hypocritical, these are double standards, they're biased. No, they're doing their job. Their job is to do what the oligarchs want them to do. If they don't do that, they're history.
Another big issue that is not discussed is this administration and Clinton's administration, if she wins, creating a new Cold War against Russia and China. And none of us who understand geopolitical issues would even suggest that this is a smart thing. Forget that both of those countries have enormous capacity to retaliate. But the next war, in all likelihood, will be a cyber war based upon how the National Security Agency and the Mossad work to undermine these all electrical systems in Iran. And it was uncovered, and now Iran has a massive program of hiring hackers from all over the world to create means of defending itself, but also creating its own form of malware, as has Russia and has China. And the consequences in the United States, if they were to hit us with any form of virus or malware that could knock out our grids, is that we could have disasters here. And this isn't even being discussed. And this is what goes wrong when you start posturing against Russia, because Vladimir Putin doesn't have any intention of having a Cold War and destroy what he has built for his country, nor China. They don't want war. But America is just biting at it. The neocons, the Kagans, and the Clintons. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the neocons have this ideology of American hegemony over the world. They've declared this ideology. Paul Wolfowitz wrote it into American war doctrine, into American foreign policy doctrine in the early 90s, I think 1992. He said that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's no longer a constraint on American power, and that the principal function of American diplomacy is to prevent the rise of any other country that could possibly constrain American unilateralism. So that's why Washington is against Russia and China, because they have risen up, they're strong, they're independent. We haven't been able to turn them into vassals the way we were able to turn France and Germany and Canada and Australia and the United Kingdom. And so they are now acting as constraints on our policy. When Obama framed up Assad with phony charges that he had used chemical weapons against his own people, and now we're going to invade, he said, and the Russians said, no, you're not. We're going to solve it diplomatically. Don't send your army here. Well, that really upset the neocons. They said, my God, they've stood up to us and backed us down. And that's when we started on Ukraine. The neocons said, what can we do to pay them back and to give them so many problems that they'll get out of our way? Oh, I know. We'll use all of the NGOs that we've been financing in the Ukraine for the past 10 years. We spent $5 billion on these people. We've got all those politicians we've hired. We'll put them in the streets and have a revolution and put in our guy, and then all the trouble that Russia will have, then we'll be able to go about doing our business in Syria and Iran. So, but that didn't work either. We didn't get Crimea. We wanted their naval base in order to exclude them from a warm water port, to exclude them from the Mediterranean. We failed again. And so now we're more agitated than ever. I mean, the neocons who run the foreign policy of the country. are more agitated than ever. And now the plan is, okay, we are putting these anti-ballistic missiles into Poland and into Romania. And we've told the Russians that these are not directed toward them, they're directed toward Iranian ICBMs. And everybody knows Iran hasn't got any ICBMs, and so the Russians don't believe it. And then the Russians also know that these so-called anti-ballistic missiles can be overnight swapped out for first strike nuclear attack missiles, in which case they can hit the Russian targets in a minute or two, in which case the Russian strategic deterrent is useless. And so this is a very, very aggressive step for Washington to take toward a power such as Russia. Putin has described the threat. He has described it exactly as I just did, that they can switch these ABMs out overnight. The host country won't even have to know. And they become strategic attack missiles. And then they can call us up and say, you can surrender or you're dead. And he says, we're not going to accept this. So we may find a very hot war very soon, because the establishment of these bases is very close at hand. In fact, I'm not sure the Romanian one hasn't already happened. The Polish one is supposed to come in the next year or two. So that's the window you have before you may experience nuclear war.
We need people in office who understand the consequences of the dangers of the neocon philosophy. The new book, The Neoconservative Threat to World Order, Washington's Perilous War for Hegemony, by Paul Craig Roberts, and his website is paulcraigroberts.org. Thank you for being with us today, Paul.
Well, Gary, it's a pleasure to speak with you and appreciate the efforts that you make in behalf of the country.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying.